Well, what's up and welcome to Sweathead with Mark Pollard. Today I have David Moore and Carolyn Barclay, who are co-founders of the B2B creative agency called Kingswood and Palmerston. Carolyn is in Melbourne. David is in the US of A. And today we're going to talk about creativity and ideas in general and what's going on with them in this industry. Why are there so few of them these days? And we'll also talk about creativity in the B2B space. David and Carolyn, welcome.
Hello, Mark.
Good to see you. Good to be here.
All right, David. So we're going to jump onto a topic that you spoke about at the Sweathead Do Together recently about the shift from idea and creativity-centric advertising to what seems to be a lot of focus on formats and data and speed. What's your take on the question, like, where have all the ideas gone?
I think all the ideas have gone into the black hole of data and chasing data and doing character counts. We focus too much on the execution and not enough on the idea. And I think that is to the detriment of our clients and the work that we try to do.
Carolyn, you've both set up a consultancy that focuses on B2B marketing, B2B advertising. B2B is relatively notorious for not really enjoying ideas at all. How do you find B2B clients and their response to maybe more provocative, more cheeky, more interesting thinking? Are they more interested in the data and the logic? How do you find the response out there in the market?
There does tend to be a fair bit of resistance to creative ideas. I think it's because you're often working with technical experts. So they want to talk about product features, service features, getting them to move away from that and just like literally lift the conversation higher up and talk about from the customer's point of view can be challenging. But I think once they wrap their head around it and see the opportunity, because the opportunities for a B2B to stand out are huge because no one's doing it. So you can be the first person in the category to really have something that you stand for and something to say. And I think once you frame it up like that, you can often get that buy-in. It's just a matter of making that case.
So I guess you got two shifts there. One is to get the business operator to think about their customer first, which you talked about there, but then also to want creativity, to see creativity as being able to give them some kind of competitive advantage. Why do you think so many operators can struggle with seeing things the way they communicate and even the experience from their customer's lens?
A lot of these B2B businesses are very sales-led rather than marketing-led. They've got their sales guys and they have a very short-term view. Salespeople have to get their results within a quarter. They're not taking a brand-building view of that approach to promoting themselves. But I'd encourage anyone who is in the marketing role to sort of take that 95-5% rule that people are talking about so much in short-term, long-term brand-building exercises and say, well, I'll let the 5% fall to the salespeople for activation service activities, and I'll own the 95% that aren't in the market right now. The unfortunate thing from our point of view is sometimes there is no marketing person in the B2B business. Often it's just some poor assistant type person who's maybe in charge of the social media. I've often heard them referred to as the colouring in department, which I know we all hate. So
David, when you're talking or thinking about how ideas seem to be less common these days, how sure are you of that? How do you know it's not just romanticizing the past?
I think because I've spent a few decades in this and I see the work and I'm a student of the work that's out there. And so much of what I see has gone from an idea that makes me stop and think and involves me as a reader or a viewer to just somebody shouting at me, trying to tell me they're the best, your trusted partner, they're the leader in innovation. There are few ideas. It doesn't mean there aren't some, but so many of them that I've seen and experienced and that I talk to and the peers I talk to are all seeing the exact same thing. They have a client who wants to replicate what their competitors are doing. Well, that's what they're doing, so we should be doing it too. And of course, you try to tell them, well, no, that's your opportunity to not do that. But that's what they end up doing. It seems to be a best practice to build a website to go and first look at your competitors' websites and then replicate theirs. And to me, I mean, that following best practices is something you should only do if you want to be a follower. If you want to lead, you need to be out there forging new ground.
And so, David, if you enjoy ideas and if you lament the disappearance or the decline in creativity in ideas in advertising, why co-found an organization or a company that focuses on B2B? Because B2B is notorious for, I believe, having lower creative standards.
I think the opportunity in B2B is huge because there are so few out there taking that leap of an idea. We don't need everybody in the world to buy into this. We need a client a month who gets it, who understands it, and that work will stand out. I think that's the opportunity. Find somebody who will grasp your pitch. If they don't get it and don't believe from the get-go, then we really don't have time to spend trying to convince them, because there's somebody else who will, and they will see the profit quickly.
Right. I mean, what kind of work, Carolyn, are you doing with these companies? Because I know if they have a marketing department, if they have a sales and marketing department, B2B organizations are often really trying to wrap their heads around CRM, things like HubSpot, automations, emails, direct marketing. Like, there's so much bitty stuff for them to wrap their heads around. How do you come in and work with them?
Come in and try to work at the idea level, at the positioning level. Say, who are you compared to your competitive set? What's the opportunity? And then spend a lot of time talking about how do you sound? How do you look? How do you go to market that way? One of the things that we try to do is say, be a little bit unexpected. So it takes, to your point, a buy-in from the very top. It doesn't work terribly well if you're dealing with a lower level marketing person, but if you are able to get into the CEO or the CMO or someone at that level, they can usually see the value of it, and they have a little more long-term thinking rather than what's my next performance evaluation going to say.
Now, Carolyn, are you adapting the ideas that you come up with, the strategies that you come up with, sort of down the funnel, or do these things exist, the more creative things exist separately from all the bitty stuff that's going on in the sales and marketing functions?
I think typically with the bitty things like a website or a tactic are usually our Trojan horse into the business. And then once we start presenting that strategy work, I think it's easier for them to conceptualize. You know, David has this very rough sketch that he trots out with idea at the center and then all these radiating things that are the expressions of the idea. And I think that visual really helps people start to see, you know, once I've got this idea that's driving, say, it's often a website, you know, people want to redo their website. Once they kind of see how you could reapply that same driving idea to all their other tactics, that it's usually, yeah, it's not too far a leap to make to go, okay, maybe we do need to overhaul everything to bring it all into line, make it more effective.
Yeah. So David, let's get you to talk through that diagram. It's one of those kinds of diagrams that I used to see 20 plus years ago in agencies, when they were trying to help big clients understand that a TV script is great, but if there's an idea in the center of it, then it can go into all the different channels. So talk us through how you explain that to somebody who is really focused on the bitty stuff.
I'm surprised that it is a challenge to explain that concept to a lot of people. And that's why I ended up sketching it out one time, trying to tell somebody, well, no, you need to have an idea at the center. Don't think of your website or your social media or your trade show booth as an island out there. So we say, hey, but if you have an idea and you put that at the middle, everything you do around it then supports that idea. And what that does is it makes your work so much more efficient and effective. And once you can start to say that word, you know, everyone seems to be all about efficiency. That's why they think digital communication and one-to-one, they believe, is so good, because, oh, it's so efficient. Well, it's even more efficient if your client or your prospect sees the same idea, not the same words. I think that's the interesting part. It's not the same words, but the same idea. They see it here in this meeting. They see it expressed here. They see it expressed there. You know, one of the easy ones to go to is Volvo. For years and years and years, Volvo stood for safety. Well, you can say that. You can do the long copy version. It talks about all the safety features you can do. You can create a TV ad where they're going to hang a car over a person that if the car fails, the person dies. Or they can do an ad that is nothing but the car in the shape of a safety pin. Everywhere you see it, though, you associate Volvo with safety. And that's the beauty of having an idea. And some of this, I think, came from just, I used to spend a lot of time going to trade shows. You'd walk down the trade show aisle and every booth heading was the same thing. Your trusted partner, the leader in innovation, and it's like they all blend together. And if you have an idea, though, where the prospect sees you at the trade show booth, they later see you online somewhere, they get a piece of mail from you, and they're all supporting that same idea. Now, the value in that idea is so much more efficient. It's so much more valuable. It's a multiplier.
Just on that, for someone who's maybe newer to the concept of what an idea is, how would you split, say, a television ad script and a tagline from an idea to help someone understand that? So, for example, the way you explain the Volvo example, safety is the thing that they were trying to position themselves with, and then you gave an example of a tactic, right? But that tactic could be a big campaign idea if all of the legs of the campaign were hanging cars over people. So let's take it the next step. How do you help someone splice apart the tagline, the TV script, from something that's more central, an idea that's more central?
All of those pieces are expressions of the idea. I love it if the core idea can be a single word or a single sentence. Then you start to figure out, okay, how do I say that in different ways? I had a client several years ago, and they were in building products, and they were in stone products. Okay, they made brick and stone and things around that. And they had a multitude of audiences. They had architects and designers. They had masons. They had distributors. They had everybody, and even consumers. Well, everybody seemed to have a different need, right? But what they all had in common is the benefit that they could tie to that was strong. They all wanted a strong company, a strong partner. So what you do is you start to express that not just in saying we're strong, but in visually. All the typefaces and in anything we do need to be big, fat, strong letters. Imagery need to be big and bold and simple, because there is a benefit everywhere across the board. A distributor wants a strong supply chain. An architect wants a strong visual statement. A mason wants a strong product. A homeowner or building owner wants a product that's going to be strong and going to last. So you don't have to say strong, so long as you can execute that idea in an appropriate way for every channel and every medium.
Carolyn, looking at the website, or your website, you've decided to, at least in part, productize, quote unquote, productize yourself, something that a lot of people have been thinking about and wanting to do for a very long time. Why did you do that? And can you talk us through, I think you've got one main product, right, or one main package. Could you talk us through what it is and also the decision to do that?
So I think our original idea was to be the CMO's secret weapon. And doing that really came down to doing what we called a crunch and breakthrough process, which was really just going in there. And like the basis of all of this was that we kind of both of us have experienced that every CMO has some little problem that is probably worth a fair bit of revenue, but they just can't get to it. So we're hoping to take that off their desk, do the crunch and breakthrough process where we really just redefine the problem, because often they can't solve it because they're trying to solve the wrong problem. So redefine the problem, really just boil it all down to something like this driving idea, and then basically create a roadmap for them to execute on that, where we're not claiming to be able to take on the entire creative process, although we can. You know, between us, we've got a decent creative network of production people. But yeah, that's the basic premise. So, and part of that was acknowledging that a CMO might not want everyone to know that they weren't able to solve that problem. So it could potentially just be something they spend their pizza budget on for the year and get that problem solved.
Yeah, and you've been bold enough to put a price on this package on the website. How did you come up with the price? Do you want to share the price? Is it sort of private and public way?
We came up with $10,000. Basically, the psychology of pricing comes into that. You know, if it's too low, then no one's going to value what you're selling. If it's too high, it's hard to access. So $10,000 seemed like a nice round number in some ways, I think.
Yeah. So is that what you would call, that's like value-based pricing? Right. So for anybody else out there who's dreaming about productizing, I see these posts every now and then where someone's stumbled across the idea of productizing their services. I think it's actually, it can be risky. Like, it's obviously to try to help the sale happen, to make it more frictionless, easier to buy. I see the price. Great. I think it can be tricky as well, because then you have to sell a lot of products, and you might not you, but in general, for someone who's thinking through this, you might not get a chance to hear the problem that you're being asked to solve, and then work out a price that is either value-based maybe the problem's going to take a very long time if you're selling hours, right? So the pros and cons with having a price, let alone a product. Do you have any other products or is it just one?
We're in the midst of actually pivoting a little bit into direct mail. I've got a huge bee in my bonnet about that being a space that I think is smart to move into, especially for B2B. They've often got a list of about 400 people that they'd like to contact, activate. I would love to get people more into dimensional mail over just sending a letter, although we can do a lot with a letter. You send a letter in a FedEx packet, someone's going to open it, which is a much better open rate than an email, which is what most people want to default to.
So you might end up with a couple of packages, is that what I'm hearing, or products?
We'll probably keep the other product around, but I think we're really going to look at heavily leaning into the direct mail in the new year.
Talk to me a little bit more about that as a business decision. You know, obviously the agency world in general is under pressure. A lot of people are freelancing and out of work. People are setting up consultancies. People are thinking about going in-house. Like it's pretty messy out there. How do you approach a change like that? You just got a hunch about it. You're doing research into it. You're getting asked about it.
I think we're trying to be really intentional and mindful about doing that research and testing the idea to start with this time. My belief just simply comes from the fact that I have seen other businesses. I know that Gasp in the UK has some great case studies where they've had, you know, 1,000% return on investment for their clients doing direct mail. I think the fact that someone is going to open the message, it is a much more assured, you know, contact with a client that you're hoping to get their attention. It's quite measurable in a way that other campaigns are not. You can expect a response of some kind. And these days, you know, COVID's made QR codes incredibly usable and, you know, people are quite comfortable with them in a way they weren't before. And that's another thing that makes me really confident is that people have online fatigue, you know, after COVID and just spending all their time online. Everyone says, everyone's online. It's like, hey, well, then maybe being offline is a viable option if you want to be in a space where no one's currently playing. So that's probably the logic in behind that decision.
And then I found another product on the website. See what happens when you click around. David, ads for advertising agencies. You share a lot of ads for advertising agencies over the decade from history. Why is that a space that you're interested in?
Be completely honest, there's a handful of reasons for that. Number one, it's a personal passion of mine. I've spent a couple of decades in the ad agency business. What I learned, and I ran an agency, and I know that things are difficult in the margins out there. So they're always trying to come up with new ways to drive new business. But I also know that the single hardest thing to do inside an agency is to create an ad for yourself. You feel pressure. Oh my gosh, I have to do the best job. All my peers are watching. And then of course there's hours pressure. Paying clients always come first. So you never get around to doing it. I think there's an opportunity there. We've been talking with a few, have done a few small ones. And that's something that we're really looking to move into. It's not a big money maker because the hard part to get over is someone, they say, oh yeah, we should be doing that. Oh, well, why don't we just do it ourselves? That's why that we've tried to price up much more competitively, which I think is decent. If somebody wanted to throw those to us, we'd be happy doing a few of those a month. Actually working on one right now.
Smart person. Hey, pull your mind out of those timesheets for a second and take a look at the Sweathead website. We have 3 membership levels, Starter Mode, Flight Mode, and Beast Mode. They give you access to a variety of strategy masterclasses, conferences, accelerators, and online learning, some of which has been known to make people cry because they like it, they like it, they feel seen. Make the most of your mind this year or any year and visit www.sweathead.com today. Now back to the interview. David, can you tell me about some of the ads for advertising agencies that you enjoy? What stands out when you think through the history of those kinds of campaigns?
The campaign that amazes me the most is Young & Rubicam, when they were an agency, they ran a full-page ad every month in Fortune magazine from 1930 until about 1969. Not occasionally, every single month. Some of them were stinkers. Some of them were absolute brilliant. I think just the fact that they committed to doing that is amazing. It's one of the things that we believe in, particularly in B2B advertising, is that it's not a direct response piece. 95% of your customers aren't in the market for you to any particular month. But what you do is you can raise your awareness. If you can just be top of mind when they are in the market, they will look to you. The Ball Agency out of Singapore did some just brilliant, brilliant work. I've got quite a bit of that to look at. I was telling someone else this story today. We're talking about doing in the midst of a project right now with an agency. And I said, it's the goal is just to make your name aware. The agency I first worked at, and I worked there for a number of years, they had their name on the side of the building at the intersection in the city, and they were in that office for 25 years. For 25 years, everybody in town drove by that building, and they knew the name. Now, if they didn't know what business we were in, they still knew who we were. But the fact of the matter is, there was a segment of those people who drove by that building every day who were our potential customers. And when it came time for them to do an agency search, top of mind was that name that I saw every single day.
I see some of that activity in smaller cities in the US where a small agency might have a billboard. I mean, I've done a little bit of work with a PR agency called Mike Worldwide, and they've got a sign on a building over in New Jersey. One of the ads that I remember that caused a little bit of a stir was, I don't know what happened at the time, but Digitas ran a campaign, or at least an ad, 17-ish years ago, saying a new advertising agency has arrived. And what they were trying to do is tell people that they weren't just a digital shop anymore, that they were now going to be competing against the big guys. And people were a little bit scared when that happened. Did you see that campaign?
I don't think I've seen that one. I'm going to have, now I have another one to track down.
Yeah, I hope I got it right. From memory, it was Digitas. But I also just remember people in some of the agencies that I knew, they're a little bit like confronted and a bit scared. And then, you know, you've got to retrieve yourself from that state of mind if you're in an agency and then be arrogant about it. So it was interesting to see the effect of that in people's faces.
There's a lot of good agency ads out there, though. A lot of them are from the past, but there are some. There's an agency in the UK, Heavenly, does some wonderful advertising for themselves. And I spoke to the CEO and I said, did it actually work? Do you get any response? And he told me the story of being at some event, talking with somebody he didn't know, just getting to know each other, says, what do you do? And he said, I'm CEO of this agency called Heavenly. And the guy looks at him and says, what? Reaches into his pocket and pulls out a folded up copy of the ad, says, I've been meaning to call you. He's carrying it around with him because it stood out. And I think my fundamental belief is if we expect our clients to believe in the power of advertising, that, you know what, you advertise, you are investing money that will drive your business, then why don't we do it ourselves?
How did you two come to be working together? Well, take me through how you met. And then also, it's a big decision to become a co-founder with someone, especially someone somewhere else in the world. How did that happen?
It was 2020. So Twitter sort of turned into a bit of a summer camp in a way where everyone was just kind of hanging out, sharing things. And I think David posted about a John Prine song called Hello in there because he loves John Prine for the copywriter's school of lyric writing. You know, that's a great place to learn how to write really well. And I actually didn't know John Prine wrote that song. I knew the Bette Midler version, which really irks. We connected over therefore cover songs and things like that. We've got a huge love of music that we share. And over time, just started talking about things and realized there was a lot of overlaps in our point of view and our skill sets. You know, there was a real connection there. So we decided to try and do some creative projects. And we've tried a bunch of things over the years. Gone Cotty Wompling was a bit of a failed attempt at doing some free work for little pieces and thinking that that might give us that opportunity, you know, working for free. The brief is sort of, you know, handed to us and we can do what we want. Turns out no one wants anything for free. So that was an interesting experiment. So after that, we just kept trucking, kept talking around things and eventually came up with Kingswood & Palmerston.
Why commit to a co-founder? Because that's a big decision. And again, I'm thinking about people out there who are trying to work out whether they're going to stay freelancing right now, whether they're going to set up a company that might grow beyond them, or whether they really want to create their own company. But like, it's a big decision, right?
I think fundamentally in this business, you're stronger when you have a creative partner to share ideas and bounce ideas off of. And it needs to be somebody that you trust just intimately, because you need that person to tell you, oh no, that is a horrible crap idea, or that's okay, but let me bounce it back at you and make it better. You know, we speak of music, John Lennon and Paul McCartney were an amazing team. And when they went off on their own independently, yeah, they had some good stuff, but sometimes I look at that and I think John should have been there telling Paul, going, no, no, that's a horrible idea. Don't do that. And you need somebody that you have that relationship with. And Carol and I have that relationship. I'll tell her flat out, that's a brilliant idea, or I think you can do better. And she will call me out on the same things. So yeah, I think having a partner that you can rely on and you can trust and can pick up the slack for you as freelancers, because we also do a lot of freelance work, and it's lonely. You sit there and it's just you and your sketch pad, or just you and your computer screen. To have somebody to say, what do you think? Or, hey, I had this inkling of an idea, and they can take it someplace else, is just one of the most valuable things you can do.
What are your goals for the business?
Global domination.
I think David was pretty close with the, one client a month kind of goal. I try to keep goals pretty, focused and measurable. We both have our own freelance gigs on the side. So it's trying to work out how to feed the right projects into the agency while still creating boundaries for our own work is something we're still working through.
Why not fold the freelancing work into the company?
We're trying to reimagine Kingswood Palmerston based around this direct mail offering, and there's a lot that's going to be changing for us in the new year. And I think that's a discussion that we're definitely going to have as we grow and try to go all in on that organization.
These are difficult decisions, but I see a lot of people leaving or, being laid off, but they might be leaving companies. And then I see people sort of flirt with a lot of ideas almost predictably, like when I'm talking about them. So let's say someone's just lost a job or they've decided to go freelance. They think about joining a collective. Imagine if we got 12 people from different backgrounds in a room. First of all, who's the leader? Who's selling it? And what are the economics of this? Because 12 really good people, architects and singers and comedians, that's really expensive, okay? And then people might want to freelance for a little bit. My personal point of view, curious to get your take on this in a second as well, is like freelancing in the wrong hands can be like being in limbo. And then as people are freelancing, sometimes someone they're working with them will like flirt with them a little bit. Do you want to go full time? Do you want to go full time? And the person's like, oh, me, I'm wanted. And so I think freelance can put some people in a precarious position where they don't fully commit to themselves. And to me, personally, a full commitment to oneself is to actually have a business name. Whether your name's in the business name or not doesn't really matter, but it's like more of a, it pushes you through limbo. And then there's sort of often this sort of hodgepodge, I'll do a little bit of stuff with these people, a little bit of stuff with these people. I personally believe that it's hard to really get the momentum you need, because it takes, this like 3 to 5 years, I think, when you have a new thing going, to really not even find your feet, but so that other people are like, oh, that's right, I've got a need, I should call that person. It's like 3 to 5 years for you to kind of get comfortable in yourself as a business owner, for other people to think of you as well. And so, yeah, I'm just curious. I reckon, I think all in. I think it's a decade of all in. So what do you think about my point around freelance possibly being limbo for some people?
I think it is limbo for a lot of people. They do it. I have a good friend here in town who was creative director at an agency and then has been freelance for the last, at least 7 years, but he's still always looking for a full-time job. And it's like, well, no, you commit to it. And a few years ago, that's when I made the commitment. It's like, this is so much more fun. And I think the idea, though, you're right, of saying, you know what, commit to this Kingswood and Palmerston business is really the right thing to do, because I see it as the future.
I agree very much so with your premise that it is like being in limbo. I think too, the nature of freelance work is it can be quite unfocused. Unless you do choose to run it as a business, you end up taking on initially, whatever work I can get, and then trying to get comfortable with the idea that the next job is coming and I don't have to take absolutely everything that comes my way. It perpetuates that mindset. And I think it is a mindset shift from I'm trying to eat to I have a business and this is what I do and what I stand for. I want to build a brand. So yeah, there is definitely a journey to make there.
The next step after that sort of full commitment is it just us, or are we actually going to build systems around us, bring other people in, and we become the business operators? Have you discussed that?
Yeah, I mean, David has a pretty, being in the business for quite a while, has quite the network to draw upon. And I think...
But I'm talking about mindset, like literally building systems around us so that we don't really have to do the work, and potentially to grow to 10, 20, 50 people. What are you thinking?
Yeah, we have discussed that. That is part of the long-term vision, is to create something, coming back to where we began, around an idea. This is our approach to business. Our approach is we want to lean into business to business. Our goal is to do things that are unexpected. If you're coming to Kingswood and Palmerston to find an idea somebody to execute what your competitors are doing, that's not going to be us. But we believe we have, we're developing a process that can be replicated. So we're not just having to not only do the selling and do the producing, but can actually be more guiding and directing. That is the goal.
How do you get your freelance work currently, both of you?
I've tried a different tactic more recently. Finding work yourself can be very arduous and inconsistent. So I'm trying to diversify my portfolio, if you will, working a little bit with other agencies, doing, white label stuff with them. But I do get my own work as well. But again, like, you know, it ends up being quite unfocused in that sense that it's not always from a particular industry. It's not always, I've done some weird things this year. I've kind of been brought in to look at an entire business from a 360 angle and then produce a bunch of recommendations for marketing. I've been pulled in to tell the story of wellness part of a business for their reporting. You know, it's just, there's no real consistency there to what I'm offering.
It's just people that know you, they know what you do. They're like, this person can provide us some clarity. We have a problem, and they'll bring you in. David, how do you get your freelance work? And then we'll talk about the company work in a second.
I have done almost no marketing of myself as a freelancer. When I first decided I was going to do it, I sent an email to 4 people and I had work from 3 of them within a week. So those are the people that I work with and they know people. And I've been in this business a few years. So I get a lot of referrals. Say, yeah, oh, that's the guy. Yeah, talk to him. Yeah, he can do it. I don't have a website of my own for the freelance work. It's people that I've worked with over the years and they know me, and a lot of them are the creative partners that I've had in the past.
And then how do you get work for Kingswood and Palmerston?
So far, the work has been through networking, saying, hey, if you want something more than just copywriting, we're looking for a bigger strategic positioning, then you should look at us, Kingswood and Palmerston, because we're bringing in 2 very different perspectives, which I think is one of the value that we bring as a partnership. I have the years of experience. Carolyn has a fresher perspective. And I think, quite frankly, a much more gifted communicator. So you get those 2 together. And we have a project right now that we're working on that it started as a seed from a past contact. And it didn't come to us as, gee, I want you to write something. But hey, we need help positioning this company. And oh, by the way, as part of the position, can we do the website? Oh, as part of the position, can we start to launch this new brand position?
You have a clear kind of decision matrix for when something might go from a freelance job to something bigger. But isn't just from a partnership point of view, and I'm always curious about business owners and what goes on in their heads. So I'm talking to you as business owners, but isn't there a conflict of interest in this relationship? You sort of have the freelance opportunity, you've got the company opportunity. Doesn't that create a sense of, maybe not tension, but isn't there a conflict of interest in that?
Yeah, I think on some level, that's something we will need to really formalize going forward. I think as we're hoping to put more all in on Kingswood and Palmerston, we're going to have to probably revisit that decision-making matrix. If it seems like something that we could take on as KNP, as we call ourselves internally, yeah, we probably do have to make a better effort to say, okay, well, I'm showing up here as KNP and not as Carolyn or David.
I like all in, and I've just talked to a lot of people, not that you're doing this at all, but I've talked to a lot of people who've been in those limbo situations, sometimes for so long, and then increasingly they find it really hard to get out, and then maybe the work disappears. This is not at all about what you're all doing. I'm a fan of like all in business. If you're going to do it, and then crush it. Not that you asked, but that's where my energy, I'm like, go, do the thing, do it.
Absolutely. There used to be this guy on the radio years ago that would give business advice. It was a call-in radio show. And one of his things that stuck with me says, when someone wants to start a business, they said, quit your day job, go all in. Because if you're not, you're not really committing to it and you're destined to fail. There's a lot of value in that idea.
That's a provocative one. And also, I think for anyone else who's out there thinking about setting up a business, I believe the average age of a quote unquote successful entrepreneur, these things are defined in the research, I think it's much older than we're led to believe. It's 37 to 45. One of the main reasons is that if you've got a decade or two and you're able to go out on your own, you've probably built up a little bit of wealth. Maybe you've got access to banks, for example, and loans. You've got a network, you know how to do your thing a little bit. So the average age of successful entrepreneurs is definitely older than the public and social media would let us believe. What have you learned about taking this journey together? You are at a point where you're planning what's coming next. strengths and weaknesses, what's been working, what's not working. What have you learned from working together like this?
I think negotiating a relationship, especially a creative one, is always going to take time. It's going to take having a relationship that goes beyond the partnership. You have to be really, really good friends, but you have to be the kind of friends that can say you're full of shit. Because like, if you can't have that conversation, the work's going to suffer. And that's what we've always said, is the work comes first. So egos can't come into it. It's having that trust and it's having that prioritization of, you know, let's focus on what matters here. That's been a big learning.
What I've learned is to take a dose of my own medicine. Don't believe my own bullshit. I spent years, I say, leading creative departments, leading an agency. So I come into this and sometimes will say, well, this is how things are. This is how things are done. And Carolyn will tell me, well, no, does it have to be? It doesn't have to be that way. And my mindset is, but that's how it's done. Yet from a business standpoint, from a creative standpoint, that is what we're trying to fight against, saying just because it's done that way doesn't mean there isn't an opportunity to do things fresh. So I get regularly challenged on that, and I think it helps me grow, and I think it's really good for the business. So we're not just doing things, not just replicating what my couple of decades of career has been. Well, this is how things are done. And Carolyn will say, well, no, it doesn't have to be that way. And I sometimes resist that, and then I catch myself and have to say, oh, you know what? She has a point.
Final question for you both. I just want to get into a little casual racism here. I'll go with you first, David. Are there any quirks about working with Carolyn that you think are specifically Australian?
Oh my goodness. Some of the language. I don't understand. You had some phrase the other day. I was like, I have no idea what that means. No, not a clue. So that and just the time difference.
What was it?
I can't remember the phrase.
I know one I always pull out for US people is like, you know, popping down to Woolies to grab a cooked chook to the Savo for dinner, you know, because they have no idea what Arvo means. What's a cooked chook? You know, what's Woolies? Like, it's just too many words. It's like I'm speaking another language. So,
well, same question to you, Carolyn. What's a quirk of dealing with David that you think might be an Americanism?
David, you know, I love you to bits. That all Americans, a lot of Americans seem to be very resistant to the idea that a world exists beyond America. You know, like it's often they're surprised that Australia actually seems to punch above its weight in so many areas. You know, if there's a hospital in the US, oh, it's the best in the world. You know, it's just like everything America is the best in the world. That always makes me giggle.
I love it. Well, Carolyn, you just demonstrated another Aussie thing, which is the Aussie chip on the shoulder.
Yeah, definitely. Leaving my chin there.
We jumped through a few topics there, but I do find that talking to people about where they're at in life and the decisions they're making, I find that super interesting. And like I said, my energy was really about like, go all in, because limbo can rust you. Is that a mixed metaphor? It's a mixed metaphor. But limbo can definitely rust people. They can get stuck there and then it becomes their way of life, their routine, and then it can just disappear, as opposed to really possibly taking full responsibility for your ideas and for yourself and really building a business that could last for years to come, right?
There's a great quote from Sally Hogshead who wrote, I'm drawing a complete blank on the name of the book, but I'll think of it eventually. But it's a great quote. It says, being in a crap job isn't your fault. Staying in a crap job is. The danger is, so you say, you get used to the limbo, you get used to treading water, and treading water starts to feel like you're swimming, and you're really never actually getting anywhere. So yeah, you need that wake-up call.
Perfect. Well, on that note, Carolyn and David, thanks so much for joining me. If you want to check out the work that this team is doing, you can go to kingswoodandpalmerston.com. I appreciate you both for being here on Sweated today. I look forward to finding out the decisions that you make about each other in the coming weeks.
Thank you so much for having us, Mark.
It's a lot of fun.
Peace. Thank you for listening to this episode of Sweathead. If you enjoyed it, please share it with a friend, subscribe to our newsletter, find us on Instagram or LinkedIn at Sweathead. And if you're interested in finding out about our strategy, memberships, company training, or books, visit sweathead.com.